Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
I'm Kerri Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, a view into a life with schizophrenia. Sandra Allen's Uncle Bob was that fun and hip and slightly subversive relative that kids tend to be drawn to. He'd play music and crack jokes as the family gathered at a northern Minnesota lake. It was only as Sandra, who prefers the pronouns they and them, became an adult that they realized Bob was mentally ill. And when Sandra received his unpublished memoir, they began to understand what his life with schizophrenia had been like. So as Sandy joins me in the studio, I think it would be meaningful to hear about your own experience with a family member who's living with serious mental illness. How well understood is it in your family? And what has it meant to your family's identity? These are all ideas and themes that Sandy's exploring in the book. And I think your own personal experience with how the family understands mental illness, how it changes, how you think of your family would be valuable to the discussion. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and of course on Twitter at KerriNPR. Sandra Allen's new book is titled A Kind of Miraculous Paradise. Welcome. It's really good to have you in the studio.
Thank you for having me.
How long had it been since you'd seen Bob, your uncle, when this box showed up, unsolicited, by the way, on your doorstep?
Yeah, I received Bob's typewritten autobiography in the mail about 8 years ago, and I hadn't seen him very much as an adult. I had been to his house once a few years prior to that. And it was the only time I'd been to his house growing up as a kid. As you mentioned, I hung out with him a bit during family vacations in northern Minnesota. But my impression of him was pretty removed. And I was a kid. And at that point in his life, he'd been living in Northern California in a little house in the desert for a while. So my sense of him was pretty limited prior to receiving his 60-page typewritten autobiography in the mail.
It's clear that members of the family have pretty different impressions of Bob. Some members of the family worried deeply about him. Other members of the family kind of wanted to keep that distance. You, as kids do, right, you were pretty accepting of the, should I say, unpredictable ways that he would behave. I mean, you loved him and you accepted that.
I enjoyed spending time with him. I thought he was funny, and he was a guitarist, and I'm also someone who loves music, and so I think we connected in those ways. But I didn't know him very well, is kind of the truth of it. And when he mailed me his autobiography, and when I did sit down and really begin to read it, you know, what I was struck by first was how little I had known about him. You know, how little any real story about his life had been communicated to me, just, you know, kind of through the family. And how, maybe more generally, how his sense of his own life was just absolutely different than maybe what I would have guessed it would be like, based on, let's say, on his manuscript's cover page, he had typed it was a true story about being labeled a psychotic paranoid schizophrenic. So my impression of him based on a phrase like that, you know, psychotic paranoid schizophrenic, versus what his life was when I really started trying to parse, you know, this document that he'd mailed me, which was about 60 pages long and typed in all capital letters and pretty inventive with its spellings and punctuated mostly with colons. So it wasn't something that, you know, I immediately said, oh, what's, you know, it took a while to try to understand it. But the story of the book is both my telling of Bob's story of his life, But it's also about my process of learning to understand him and attempting to learn to understand that topic, schizophrenia, you know, mental health more generally. It's a book that I hope will bring more people into this conversation, because I do think there can be a big difference between how someone like Bob perceives himself,
right,
versus how, yeah, as you say, family members perceive him, and within the family even, you know, there was radically different interpretations of him and his life and that diagnosis and so on. And then also how family members like me interpreted him, you know, people more at a remove, and then how society as a whole interprets people who've been labeled with schizophrenia.
And you've used the word, and Bob used the word labeled a couple of times, but I am right in concluding from the book that he accepted the idea at some point in his life that he was schizophrenic, didn't he?
He uses the phrase labeled psychotic paranoid schizophrenic.
What does that tell you then?
Well, I mean, it's true, right? Like a doctor diagnosed him with schizophrenia. So, you know, and I think that I don't know that he was someone who was writing his book, for example, you know, to embrace that diagnosis. I don't think he was writing it to proudly claim that diagnosis. I think he was writing a critique of that diagnosis. But I think more he wanted to be heard on topics like what had happened to him in the psychiatric system, especially at a very young age. He was initially hospitalized at about age 16. And that first hospitalization was traumatic, you know, unto itself, and other topics that I think he really wanted to be heard upon, like consuming psychiatric medications for the duration of his life, really, mm-hmm. starting in about his teens. So I don't think he was someone who disagreed that there was something about himself that was different. I think it's hard to separate the experiences, for example, of being hospitalized at 16 or medicated starting at about 16, you know, from who he became. Those were part of him, those experiences. He liked to use the word nuts for himself, N-U-T-S. So sometimes in the book, you know, I'll quote him faithfully to his initial text. And so when I do that, I do it in all capital letters. So the word nuts in all capital letters does occur in my book a few times.
And how Bob talked about himself.
Yeah. And I think he had a sense of humor about it. Like there was in the process of writing the book, I tried to interview really everyone who knew him, you know, who would talk to me and ask them, hey, how do you remember this? How do you remember this? And the book contains kind of all of those memories, you know, the fact that no one's really seeing this the same way, I think, is one of the topics in the book.
I think that ends up being really important for that first hospitalization, which from Bob's experience, and I think we could just gather, was deeply traumatic.
Yeah.
And really difficult. And yet, the perspective that you provide from talking to the other family members about what was going on and what led up to being hospitalized at the young age of 16 years old, I mean, I read Bob's account and I thought, how could this have happened?
Right.
Of course, I naturally outraged, and I'm sure you were too.
Right.
Then you give me the family perspective of this, and tell me a little bit about that.
Well, and it's interesting because, you know, for the sort of story of how I wrote the book was that for the first 5 years, I was really just focused on Bob's manuscript and trying to bring his account into another form that I thought more people might be willing to read, because that was the thing that I noticed. The form of his writing was off-putting to people, but mm-hmm. I felt that the story itself and sort of the messages it had to offer were very valuable. And so I was trying to bring it into this more accessible mode. And so only in the last few years that I worked on the project was I, you know, looking outward more and interviewing people in the family, for example. So I'd spent years wondering exactly that, you know, what was going on that, you know, his dad, you know, determined that it was important to take him to the hospital at this point in time. And what was fascinating was while my grandfather was certainly certain that his son was having, you know, struggles and was really in need of help, he didn't have a very specific memory, or at least he didn't offer specific memories about what was going on. So there was kind of this gap. Bob sort of describes his hospitalization as having no cause, and my grandfather didn't necessarily tell some great story that then made very clear to me why this had happened, you know? And I think that's sort of, it's a little unsatisfying, right? That there wasn't some big incident that Bob himself had failed to mention. I think, yeah.
But I will say this, that Bob felt abandoned in that first hospitalization. In fact, is that the one where he says everybody else goes on a trip and he's left behind?
Yeah, yeah. He recounts that his dad and his girlfriend drop him off at the hospital and
just
then go up,
drop him
go
off
up to the lake. Yeah,
right. What then becomes clear is that would be utterly callous and I think out of character. As I got to know your family and Bob's family,
yeah.
I learned to be a little more skeptical about my narrator, which is exactly what you're doing here, right?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, when his dad drops him off at the hospital, you know, he's doing that because he's trying to help his son. He's trying to do what he believes is the absolute best thing to do. You know, he was someone whose point of view on all this was I bought him the best care money could buy. And he believed that wholeheartedly, you know. And Bob, I think, was aware of the fact that his dad and his stepmom had invested so much energy and money in supporting him through the course of his life. And he knew that his, quote, true story of himself would probably be perceived as a challenge to them, you know, and I think that those are just the stakes that I had as I tried to complete Bob's project here, because I think it's important to honor the fact that folks who are in the position of trying to caregive for a family member who's experiencing psychiatric crisis, whatever that is, I think that's an extremely difficult position to be in. And I think we also have to make space to try to understand how someone like Bob is perceiving himself in his own life and his own reality and such. And then I think once we're aware of all the differences between how people are interpreting these things, then I think we're at a place where we can start to think about, okay, so if and when one of us is in crisis, what do we want to have happen? What do we want available to us if we have a moment or we have a day or we have a period in our life that is severely stressed out, or we're experiencing things that are concerning those around us and so on? And I think, you know, we can look at Bob's story and I think take away lessons in terms of what helps him along the way, what doesn't help him along the way, you know, and some of the things that help him aren't incredibly, it's not tech necessarily.
Yeah.
It's things like connection with others and being around people who accept him and being in, you know, he eventually stays at a different hospital that he likes a lot more. And the things that he likes about it, you know, he likes that his doctor kind of talks to him like he's a person, and he likes that there's a piano, and he likes that there's a patio, and that he can wear whatever clothes he wants. And I think that those are examples of things that we could provide for one another, you know, more readily in the event that we're going to have a really bad day.
Sandy Allen is in the studio today. Their new book, would you call this a memoir, Sandy?
It's not I mean, it's not the story of my life. I'm definitely a character in it. But, you know, I think of it as a true story about my Uncle Bob.
Their true story about her Uncle Bob is called A Kind of Miraculous Paradise. And as you hear, it's the story of the family's perception of what it means to have a family member who is living with schizophrenia, and Bob's own perception of what that meant to be hospitalized, to want to live a full life, to love music, to love his family. And so we're talking about what Sandy learned in the process of writing this. And I'm asking you, as you listen to the conversation, if these are some of the questions you're asking yourself as a family member, perhaps as having a family member or someone in your circle of friends with serious mental illness, how well is it understood? Where does that limit of family obligation and responsibility fit in? Are you dealing with that? 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. On Twitter, a listener says, brother was schizophrenic. Dad died when my brother was 4. I was 5. Mom's life completely drained away with watching, corralling, encouraging, etc. My bro was the gentlest, most exasperating person I've ever known. He died in an accidental drowning. Do those adjectives of exasperating and gentle resonate with you?
I've heard someone say this about a different diagnosis, but I'll repeat it. If you've met one person with schizophrenia diagnosis, you've met one person with a schizophrenia diagnosis. I do think that's one of the big points here is Bob was Bob. And I think, you know, this person tweeting at you, you know, that's their relative's personality and so on. And I think one thing that I'm seeking to do in this book is try to paint a really full portrait here, because we have a tendency in our culture to hear a word like schizophrenia and then think we've heard the whole story. Right. And we have so much that we are learning, quote, about schizophrenia or about severe mental illness that is coming from the news or it's coming from the movies or TV, and it's fundamentally not informed.
This is why I think it's really essential for families and individuals to talk about what this means in your own family and mm-hmm. not, I don't know, even today feel like you have to hide that.
Yeah.
And I know some families still do feel like they have to hide it.
And these topics can be deeply painful and deeply shameful. And I think that, you know, it's the case that there's so many different reasons that someone might not want to be super forthright about something like this in their lives that is so can be really painful. But one of the real joys of being this book's author in the world right now is that I get to meet people and kind of share a moment with them. And it's a moment of connection. And it's about understanding a little bit more about this topic that tends to be very sidelined. And I think just even, you know, in the mainstream news, you know, there can be a very reductive portrait of what an individual diagnosed with schizophrenia is. And one of my big points here is I think that we need to open ourselves up to the fact that an individual who's received a diagnosis like this is still a full person, you know, and my uncle was one such person.
As
yeah.
is obvious by the life that your uncle led and wanted to leave. Mm-hmm. By the way, Sandy speaks at Excelsior Trinity Church this afternoon at 1:00, and it's an event called Mental Health in Literature. To the phones to Nadia in Maplewood. Nadia, sounds like you're going through this in your own family, yeah?
Yeah. My dad has schizophrenia, and the thing is, they immigrated from Somalia after the war, so he kind of developed it post-war, too. Mm-hmm. So when he came here, he, like, went to school. He got, like, 2 master's degrees from the University of Minnesota, but he could, like, not hold a job because of his, like, mental instability, and he didn't want to, like, get medicated. So a large part of my life was just, like, my mom trying to get him to go to the hospital so he could hold a job and support the family. And now he still doesn't, like, hold jobs, but he kind of, like, works, like, regular jobs. So me and my sister and my mom, we support him, and 2 of us are, like, full-time college students.
Wow. Yeah. That story, again, hearing what Sandy is saying about there's no monolithic experience here, but Bob went through this too. Volatile work history, family having to step in, right, and decide how involved they were going to be in his life.
Yeah. I think that our society should provide for people so that those who can't fully participate in the capitalist society can still eat and have somewhere safe to sleep and so on. You know, I think right now we sort of have a family can maybe help if someone's unable to provide for him or herself. And then if you don't have the fortune to have someone who can hand you some help, then you've got nothing, right? And I think that model, it doesn't help. And if someone, as you know, is already experiencing trauma or grief, you know, if they're experiencing something as a result of a war, you know, or of something that's happened in their life, you know, then also not being able to provide for themselves or having somewhere safe to sleep or having something to eat every day, you know, that compounds, right? And I do think that there's an interpretation here, which is if we had better options for folks who are, you know, really maxing out, who have hit the limit with mm-hmm. what they can do in their mm-hmm. lives, you know, should the responsibility fall entirely upon families? I don't think so, because it's just too much, you know. And I think the really being honest about the fact that this can happen to anyone, you know, that I think it's nice to think, oh, there's 2 kinds of people, you know, there's those insane people and then there's me and I'm sane, you know, but that's a myth, right? And I think the truth of it is that we're all susceptible here. And also caregivers, people who are in the position of trying to work another job to support another family member and, you know, care for someone and be involved in these really complicated discussions, for example, around psychiatric treatment, you know, this this takes a toll. And one of the truths I think that surrounds schizophrenia, the topic as it courses through so many families, is that yes, the individual who's been diagnosed is in a tough spot, but those people who love him and are attempting to step in and provide for him are also
and
put
who
in
only
a really
who
tough
only
spot.
Want the best and want a full life.
Absolutely,
for that person.
Absolutely.
On Twitter here, a listener says, "I was diagnosed bipolar at 19. Family doesn't really take mental illness seriously." With family and with other adults, when I was in high school, I was continually treated like I was just a bad kid. So I never got the help I needed until I sought out therapy in college. To the phones to Brett in central Minnesota. Hi, Brett. What's your experience with this been like?
For me, mostly I grew up with a single-parent home. My dad raised my sister and I, and my mom was eventually left our family because she was struggling with mental illness after both of us were born. And we were always told that she was, you know, schizophrenic, and that led to other things like alcoholism and whatnot. So I never knew much about it. Well, now that I'm older, I'm 40 years old now, I've gotten to know my mom, and I'm not able to visit her. She lives far away, but I'm still able to keep in touch with her, and she's in a mental hospital permanently, basically, but we carry on great conversations now. It seems like because she has that structure of the help that she needs there, we're able to function in it. It's always been confusing to me what is going on there, because it seems like from what I've read, schizophrenia is degenerative, and as the person get older, it could get worse. She doesn't seem to be. I don't know if you have any comments on that.
Sandy, any knowledge on that?
Well, I hope this doesn't sound too self-serving, but I hope you get a chance to read my book. I've really tried to write this book for people who I think might have a sort of lingering set of questions about what this diagnosis is, what's known, where psychiatric treatments enter all this, you know, what when there are these big debates about, oh, an individual doesn't want to take their meds or, you know, and I tried to write a story that was not too long and not too dense and kind of fun to read, and also, brings in some good information here, because I do think that what has happened for some decades, especially in this country, is there has been one set of points of view here that is, you know, pretty influenced by pharmaceutical money, wants us to believe certain things about these diagnoses and about what they are and aren't. And I think the main thing I want to respect here is that it's really complicated, and that there are individuals who have a diagnosis like bipolar or like schizophrenia who really embrace that diagnosis and take meaning from that, and, you know, feel that, for example, psychiatric medication has been a huge part of how they've been able to survive and live their lives fully and with dignity. And there are people like my uncle who I think are sort of on the opposite end of that. And the challenge I think I'm posing to my readers, you know, through writing this book is, well, how do we respect all of these points of view? You know, because I don't think it's going to be the case that we're ever going to convince everyone here that it all needs to be seen one way. But I think finding common values is a big part of it. And the fact that you've been able to connect with your mom late in life, you know, I think that's really rad.
One of the things that Bob, that stood out for me in some of the things that Bob was writing in the autobiography about the hospitalizations and how the family sometimes had to step in. He says, "I'm grateful yet resentful at the same time." Oh, I think that's probably a common feeling,
right?
As an adult with mental illness, where sometimes you need the support. We all need the support in some ways. Sometimes you need the support of a family member stepping in to direct your life in some ways, in a way that you wish wasn't necessary.
Right.
He really captures that, the ambivalence of that.
It's a nuanced point that he's seeking to make in his autobiography. And that's one of the things that I'm attempting to do right by in my presentation of his story, is I want us to understand that exact conflict, because I think that is really one of the central conflicts here. He is, I think, through the course of his life, aware of the fact that the situation he's in is unfair, you know, that he's up against, you know, for example, a psychiatric system that when he first encounters it, treats him in these really dehumanizing ways, and very disoriented, you know, disorienting and so on. And yet he also knows throughout the course of his story that he ends up in situations when really what happens when he's in his 20s is he has kind of a hospital that his family is able to afford that he just returns to periodically when he sort of hits a point in his life when he can't be out there in the world anymore. And I think part
of... to accept that.
Well, I think part of it is that, you know, if all of us were to let go a little bit of what normal has to be here, you know, what normal job holding is, or what normal friend having is, or normal relationships. You know, in the case of Bob, when he moved to the desert in about 1980, he lived in a little house by himself for decades until he died just fine. He had financial support from the government and from his family, but he took care of himself. He kept his own checkbook. He took his meds. He played guitar. He read the Bible. He cared for his dogs. He was friends with his neighbors. He called family on the phone. You know, he did fine. And what helped him was he was a self-identified hermit who lived in the desert, and he didn't necessarily, you know, conform to what we expect, you know, a person in our society to have to be. Well, it seemed like that worked out just fine for him. And so I think that part of it is, what if we allowed ourselves, you know, to open up our sense of what a person has to be. And, you know, I think in Bob's case, he knew pretty well how to take care of himself, is one of the things that I think you come to realize as you read his story.
Let me take a call here from Kevin in Minneapolis. Hi, Kevin. I'm glad you called. What's your experience with this?
Hi. I am, as of almost exactly a year ago now, my sister's legal guardian and conservator, after she had a major paranoid schizophrenic episode at work. And, you know, the journey of, you know, spending more time in mental hospitals than I can care to, being mistaken for a patient with her, and then getting her back into work. She works a good job, oddly. You know, she's kind of a strange, you know, highly rational, irrational person. But just, you know, working, trying to get her back to work, trying to manage her finances, trying to manage the family issues. And then to your last point you were making about grateful yet resentful. I mean, I'm the brother who's close enough but far enough away. She's in a different state, you know, but I just know she's going to turn on me at some point, you know.
And you feel that, Kevin, because you've had to be more involved with decision making for her than she would want you to be?
Yeah, I mean, I run her life, right? I mean, I try to do that as considerately as possible. I manage all of her money. You know, she can't sign any contracts. I mean, the whole legal guardian conservator thing, people don't realize, it's not like power of attorney. It's like the state says you're responsible for this person. They can't make any decisions.
Right.
And, you know, and it's dehumanizing, but, you know, so I try to do that in as human a way as possible. So, you know, how long is that going to play out that, you know, she's still
turns
okay
to you
with that?
Right.
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 One thing that what you're pointing out makes me think about is how I think in general, you know, those who end up suddenly involved with this system learn a lot about what's actually going on, you know, as you say, with legal guardianship, for example. But topics like involuntary commitment, involuntary medication, involuntary electroshock, these are things that folks don't necessarily know anything about until suddenly they're faced with, you know, a very intense decision involving themselves, involving a loved one. And I think that's one of the reasons I wanted to write a book that I hoped that people who had no active stake already in this topic might be willing to read, because I think that more of us need to think about what is going on in terms of the psychiatric system as constituted. And then one of the things that I'm really interested in is continuing to ask the question, does the way we do it now make the most sense in terms of those who are suffering, in terms of that individual, in terms of the family around him or her? And what else might we be providing for that will help people when they reach these moments of crisis, as you mentioned your sister did?
Bob was a music lover and would you say a somewhat accomplished guitar player?
Yeah.
More, maybe I shouldn't say somewhat, an accomplished guitar player.
For sure, yeah. He was a Hendrix-loving, you know, child of Berkeley in the 60s. And I think he was a quite devoted musician. And I think he wrote down his life story on his typewriter and mailed it to me. But his real artistic form was music, and he recorded a lot of cassette tapes in those decades.
Do you have those?
Oh yeah, I have a lot of tapes, and I've been digitizing them, and I'm going to figure out what to do with them.
I was going to say, so what? How did knowing him, besides reading the autobiography, come from listening to the way he thought about music and played music? What it meant to him?
I think it was one of the ways that I stayed interested in this project through the 8 years that I was working on it was I would listen to not only his music, but a lot of the music that I think really shaped him. And I think part of what I identify with in his story is I'm a bit of a weirdo, and I'm a bit of an, you know, I'm a bit of a music lover. And I think that these were things that I felt we had in common. You know, not all of us show up on the earth and feel like artists, but some of us do. And I think that was probably one of those qualities that Bob probably saw in me. And it was probably one of the reasons that he decided to, you know, mail me his typewritten original autobiography manuscript and charge me with getting the story out there, which is what he said he wanted.
We're going to play a little Hendrix music to close here, but I do want to say that living up there in the desert and playing his guitar, being alone mm-hmm. a lot of the time, mm-hmm. you do evoke this sense of loneliness that he experienced a lot. I know music was a help with that.
Yeah.
But it's unavoidable to understand that he was lonely in big parts of his life.
It's another of those great conflicts, I think, that really fuels his story. Yes, I think he was lonely, and I think his hermitage was lonely. And yet, I think he was also a very faithful person, for example. I think he felt very close to God, and I think that Christianity was a big part of how he stayed okay through those decades. Same with music. I think music was a big part of how he kept all right, and I think recording those cassette tapes, for example, you know, he would mail them to relatives and such, and yet, you know, I think he made music the way that any artist makes something, sort of feeling like someone out there might hear it. So, for example, at the very beginning of the audiobook version of my book, there is one of Bob's songs. So if you're an audiobook
cool.
lover, if you download the audiobook of A Kind of Miraculous Paradise, it opens with one of Bob's tracks, although this is Hendrix.
This is Jimi Hendrix, Hear My Train A Comin'. Thank you, Sandy.
Thank
Good
you.
Good to have you here.